This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Kenya is also highly encouraged by the great interest shown by Iran in promoting technological and entrepreneurial innovation among Kenyan youth by promoting incubation of Kenya's startups and creative industry.
That's Kenyan President William Ruto after Iranian counterpart Ibrahim Raisi finished the first leg of his three-nation visit to Africa. Details coming up. Also, Egypt hosts a summit tomorrow in the latest effort to end Sudan's conflict. And 8 Sahel countries are meeting to ease conflicts between farmers and nomadic herders. These stories and more on African News Tonight. Kenyan President William Ruto welcomed Iranian counterpart Ibrahim Raisi to Nairobi on Wednesday for the first leg of a three-nation trip that aims to bolster Iran's political, economic and trade ties with Africa. He later went to Uganda, with Zimbabwe next on his schedule. VOA Africa correspondent Maria Madialo has the story.
Highly productive is how President William Ruto described meetings with Ibrahim Raisi as Ruto hosted his Iranian counterpart at the State House in Nairobi. Ruto said stronger collaboration with Iran is important for the Kenyan economy and that trade volumes between their nations have increased.
Kenya exported tea worth $28.4 million, about 4 billion shillings, to Tehran in the first quarter of this year, which is an eightfold increase from sales for the same period last year. Kenya is also highly encouraged by the great interest shown by Iran in promoting technological and entrepreneurial innovation among Kenyan youth by promoting incubation of Kenya's startups and creative industry through the Iran House Innovation and Technology Center.
Ruto also reported good news for Kenya's mechanical and automotive industries.
Iran's intention to set up a motor vehicle assembly plant in Mombasa to manufacture an indigenous Iranian vehicle that has now been given the Kiswahili name Kifaru, meaning rhino. And I hope it will be a tough one, Your Excellency. I am confident that the project is unstoppable, as this name suggests.
The two leaders signed agreements to increase cooperation on information and technology, fisheries, animal health, livestock products, and investment promotion. Through an interpreter, President Raisi said this is a turning point in the development of relations between Iran and Kenya.
With the talks and exchange of notes that we had with the president with the meeting earlier today, we registered the determination and resolve of both countries for expansion of economic and trade cooperation, political cooperation, cultural cooperation between two countries. And I hope that the authorities and the official relevant authorities and officials in both countries could exercise a lot of effort in order to provide the groundwork for further cooperation of relation between two countries, which also could lead to development of regional cooperation.
With Raisi's visit, Iran joins China, Russia, the United States, and other countries in seeking to strengthen diplomatic and trade links on the African continent. Javis Bigambo is a lawyer and governance specialist based in Nairobi. He notes this is the first time an Iranian president has visited Kenya in 11 years.
When you look at also the issue of Africa, and Kenya being a significant nation on matters of geopolitics in the Horn of Africa, then Kenya becomes a very important nation within the continental politics of Africa. And so I think, one, beyond sending a message to the West and to the friends and even the enemies of Iran, President Raisi possibly wants to demonstrate that he is unafraid to reach out to nations that are friendly to the West, and Kenya in this case, even though themselves do not have a particularly rosy friend relationship with the West.
The U.S. and its allies have moved to isolate Iran because of its nuclear program, human rights record, and anti-Western ideology. Iran has maintained its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. In an attempt to reduce its isolation and offset sanctions, Iran recently restored ties with regional rival Saudi Arabia. Also, President Raisi embarked on a Latin America tour last month. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Ministers from eight of Africa's Sahel region countries are meeting in Cameroon to try to end conflicts between farmers and nomadic herders. The ministers say seasonal movement of livestock north from the Sahel is fueling clashes between the communities and says a peacekeeping effort is needed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
African ministers of transboundary transhumans or seasonal movement of livestock say the practice is threatening resources and fueling farmer-herder conflicts. The meeting Wednesday in Yaoundé included ministers from Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Democratic Republic of Congo, Niger, Nigeria, South Sudan, and Sudan. They say in the past 20 years, clashes between the communities in the Sahel region increased from 30 per year to more than 200, with about 800 deaths in the Central African Republic, CAR, alone. The African Union says transboundary pastoralism in the CAR, one of the worst affected, is practiced by herders from Cameroon, Chad, South Sudan, and Sudan. Cameroon's livestock minister, who goes by only one name, Tiger, hosted the second international conference on the issue.
La transhumance est un mode d'élevage, un mode de vie, c'est une technique d'élevage.
Tiger says cattle theft, banditry, robbery, farmer-herder conflicts, pressure on natural resources and intercommunal conflicts, and many other incidents of transhumans activities are not given adequate attention by African governments, international organizations, and communities. The ministers said several thousand civilians displaced by the conflicts were yet to be resettled. Tiger said an immediate task for the eight countries was to establish buffer zones and protect existing corridors to safeguard the livelihoods of 270 million African pastoralists. Kenyan-born Japhet Kasimbu works with the East African Regional Bloc IGAD. Kasimbu says IGAD members, Djibouti, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan and Uganda found ways to reduce clashes.
Our region came up with a protocol on transhumans to regulate, to facilitate cross-border mobility of livestock and herders to access water, to access pasture, even to enable the countries to do joint vaccinations and promote livestock keeping by pastoral communities.
The three-day Yaoundé conference, which ended Wednesday, is calling for peacekeeping operations to reduce growing conflicts from the pastoralists. German Christian Rook attended the conference for the Congo Basin Forest Partnership, CBPF, one of the founders. He says Africa's Sahel region needs to better police farmers and herders to prevent clashes, but also provide more resources to the communities.
It was a declaration of development and defense because it's also a security issue. And we want to transfer this declaration to action plans, not only talking. We need water holes, veterinary stations. It has a lot to do with information for the herders. Where is the rain? Where will be the rain? The most important thing is more education for the people to mitigate the consequences of the transhumance.
The conference was initiated in 2022 with support from the Economic Community of Central African States, ECAS, and the Central African Forest Commission, COMIFAC. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Fighting in Sudan continued today with Reuters News reporting artillery shelling in Omdurman and Bari, parts of the capital Khartoum. Combat also has been reported in the recent days in South Kordofan State and in Blue Nile State near the border with Ethiopia. Britain today announced sanctions on businesses it said are associated with the Sudanese army and its rival Rapid Support Forces. The conflict began in mid-April when Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who commands the paramilitary RSF, turned on each other. Also today, the head of the United Nations mission in Sudan said the two sides must face accountability for crimes committed in the conflict. Volker Perthier said the fighting risks morphing into an ethnicized, tribalized, and ideologized conflict. The International Organization for Migration says the fighting has killed about 3,000 people and uprooted about 3 million. Egypt is hosting a summit of Sudan's neighbors tomorrow in hopes of coming up with a way to peacefully end the 12-week-old conflict in Sudan. After several failed ceasefires and diplomatic efforts to halt the fighting between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Forces, many are wondering if Egypt, which is considered a close ally of Sudan's army, will be able to pull it off. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that more than 250,000 refugees have poured into Egypt, giving it a strong incentive to restore stability in its neighbor.
More and more of these people are now coming into Cairo and being very much a part of the daily life there. And so it's front and center for Egyptians. They're feeling the impact economically and in terms of trying to provide some sort of humanitarian assistance. I think Egypt also quite clearly recognizes that a destabilized Sudan on its southern border is quite a security risk for Egypt. And it provides an opportunity for external actors to gain a foothold and threaten Egypt in other ways.
That is true, but isn't Egypt seen as an ally to the Sudanese army? And isn't that a problem going forward, or is it with this summit?
Well, the government under President Sisi and Egypt has all along favored a continuation of a military government in Sudan. This is consistent with what Egypt itself has done and how Sisi himself has come to power. And he has an affinity with the military actors, and he clearly doesn't want to see democracy get established in Sudan, as this would create a precedent and some expectation that Egypt itself would democratize. So it's a fair point, but I think given the possible scenario of a fragmented, protracted conflict in Sudan that could spin out of control in a lot of different ways, that is far more threatening immediately to Egypt. And so I think we have to take at face value that it's a genuine attempt by the Egyptians to move things forward.
What about these two fighting sides, the Sudanese army and the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces? Now, as the weeks have gone on and, the atrocities have been committed, it sounds like, with the reports that have gone to Human Rights Watch and others are reporting, civilians are blaming the RSF for rape and those kinds of atrocities more so, not that they're alone, but more so than the army. Have you heard any reports like that?
The reports we get from Sudan, of course, are very fragmented, given the difficulty of reporting, and all sides are alleged to be involved in violations against civilians. That said, yes, the RSF comes in for special notoriety for looting, for human rights abuses, and other sorts of extrajudicial actions against civilians. And we're seeing this especially in Darfur in the last few weeks, especially it has ramped up. The Arab militias affiliated with the RSF have dropped any pretense that this is a military conflict, and have really gone after African populations in western Darfur, especially the Masalit Pasha population, seizing land, taking property, and extorting civilians on the road. And so they're really seeing this as a criminal opportunity, and we're really seeing echoes of the genocide in Darfur from the 2000s.
That is Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam, in Washington. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Kenyan police today fired tear gas at people who defied a ban on an anti-taxes protest called by opposition leader Raila Odinga. The French news agency AFP says shops were shut and security was tight in the capital, Nairobi, where police deployed tear gas against stone-throwing demonstrators in the slum of Matare. Tear gas also was used to disperse crowds in the port city of Mombasa. The clashes followed rallies in several cities last week that turned deadly. The Interior Ministry said 6 people were killed and rights campaigners accused police of being heavy-handed. Yesterday, Kenya's police chief warned opposition supporters from holding illegal demonstrations. He said organizers had not provided authorities with any notifications about planned rallies this week. The protesters cite public disapproval of soaring prices of food and other basic goods that are adding pressure on households. The government says the taxes will help create jobs and reduce public borrowing. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said Sunday that next month's BRICS summit, which Vladimir Putin has been invited to attend, will be held in person despite an arrest warrant for the Russian leader. South Africa is the current chair of BRICS, a group of major developing economies that includes Brazil, Russia, India, and China, to challenge the dominant U.S. and European-led global governance structures. Mvemba Fizo-Dizolele is director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. He told me that BRICS has caught South Africa between a rock and a hard place.
What should we make of it? Maybe there are two levels. One is, as member of the BRICS, I think South Africa wants to have a common front with the partners of the BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and decide to take their position as a bloc. And South Africa being part of that bloc, I suppose this is part of the drivers of that position. There is another level which is alarming to a lot of analysts around the world, which is that South Africa is signatory to the Protocol for International Justice, which is the one that is calling for this warrant that you mentioned. So I think South Africa is caught between those two currents.
As a member of the ICC, like you just mentioned, South Africa would be expected to arrest Putin if he sets foot in the country. That's what you're saying?
That is correct. If as a signatory, I think it's to the Rome Convention and the ICC and so on, South Africa then is bound by that treaty. But I think South Africa, as a member of the BRICS, are facing certain pressures, which is making it difficult for South Africa to approach this.
South Africa, yes, is the current chair of BRICS, you know, the grouping you just mentioned with the heavyweights, including Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But still, South Africa is a very close ally of the United States as well. A group of U.S. senators recently questioned South Africa's status under the African Growth and Opportunity Act, citing Pretoria's ties with Moscow, you know, AGOA. Could that be affected by this move by South Africa?
Of course it can be affected. The U.S. is a sovereign country, just as South Africa is a sovereign country. South Africa is a country, is the largest trading partner of the United States, which also means that the U.S. is a major partner of South Africa. Both countries stand more to gain, and there's no real point of both countries antagonizing one another and then entering into a losing arrangement. This also makes the relationship between the two countries complicated. South Africa is definitely a trading partner to the United States, an important one. So the United States cannot just bully South Africa or push it whichever way. South Africa is also an important country on the continent, both economically and politically. This makes it difficult to come to an easy solution to, quote unquote, this crisis, if we can call it that.
But sir, South Africa, it has not condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine, saying it is impartial and prefers dialogue, which it is pushing for.
That is also a legitimate point that the South African make as an independent sovereign country. They are entitled to having their position, just as the United States and other countries in the world have taken various positions on this issue. It is important also to understand the background beyond this. South Africa fought apartheid. South Africa went through a bloody period for a number of years, decades, where black South Africans and other peoples of color in that country had wanted equal rights with their white counterparts. Eventually, they were able to achieve that, not to the end of the barrel of the gun, but rather to dialogue. And that's how the Rainbow Nation was built, with all its challenges. So at the core, South Africans believe in dialogue. And when South Africans say that, I think we need to try to dissociate that with whatever proximity they may or may not have with the Russians. The issue here at hand is what? Ukraine. If the issue is Ukraine, South Africa, to a certain extent, only to a certain extent, South Africa is not the only country in Africa. It's an important African country. South Africa reflects a position that a lot of African countries have also taken. And that position is, this is a European issue. They rather see Europeans resolve it.
That was Mvemba Vizo-Dizolele, director of the African program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, speaking with me from Washington, D.C. And in the world of tennis sports, Tunisia's Ons Jabeur ousted Wimbledon's defending champion Elena Rybakina today in the quarterfinals. Jabeur's three-set victory avenges her defeat to Rybakina in last year's final. She moves on to the semifinals tomorrow. Jabeur, who is a fan favorite in her home country, aims to make it to the finals for the second year in a row, giving her another shot at becoming the first African and Arab woman to win one of the biggest events in the tennis world. VOA's English to Africa service celebrates its 60th anniversary on August 4th. Help us celebrate by sharing your thoughts on our programs. Send a voice message or a text to this WhatsApp number +1202-258-3076. Tell us what your favorite program is, or let us know about a report we did that mattered to you. Recall a favorite memory about VOA Africa, or tell us what stories you think we should cover or how we can improve. That number again is +1202-258-3076. Tell us your name and where you live, and you might hear your comments on our shows. And thanks for 60 years of support. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.